Chapter 10 Divine Splendor. Introduction. Krishna goes deeper into the revelation of his divine being, revealing himself as the source from which all things come, the one who is the reality behind the many. Though the source of all virtues, he is also the ultimate reality that transcends all opposites. Thus he is both happiness and suffering, birth and death, being and non-being. Like the Brahman of the Upanishads, he is beyond duality, utterly beyond the constricting categories of the things of this world. His true nature is beyond the reach of thought. He can only be known in the state of samadhi, where knower and known become one. Arjuna calls Krishna Purushottama, the supreme Purusha, the supreme person. Krishna is now no human charioteer, but Bhagwan, the munificent Lord. And Arjuna, leaving his warrior persona behind, now stands revealed as a seeker after truth. At Arjuna's request, Krishna now reveals a few of his divine powers and attributes, vibhutis. From this point on, the chapter becomes difficult because of the many unfamiliar names that are mentioned. In whatever category, Krishna is the chief, the best, the most intense, the most beautiful, the most awesome, the essence. Many of the allusions will be familiar. For example, among rivers, Krishna is the Ganges. But many of the names come from Hindu mythology and are not well known. There is no room here to explain every name, but the following paragraphs will highlight a few of importance. First, Krishna is the Atman, the inner self in all beings. It is fitting that this be mentioned first, for of all his myriad manifestations, this is the most important, at least to the struggling spiritual aspirant that is Arjuna. Krishna is Arjuna's innermost self, and that is how he is to be known in contemplation. Of all the forms in which to meditate upon Krishna, the Atman is mentioned first. Krishna is Vishnu, the great, compassionate, sustaining God of the Hindu faith. It is Vishnu who cares so much about the sufferings of Mother Earth and her children that he comes to Earth again and again, in age after age, to relieve oppression and renew righteousness. Krishna is the sun, worshipped in India since ancient times. He is Indra, the chief of the Vedic gods, the lord of storm and battle, who hurls the thunderbolt against the enemies of the gods. In Vedic religion, he is a mighty lord, not to be trifled with. But later on, he must admit defeat at the hands of Krishna, who protects the people from Indra's stormy wrath. Krishna is also Shankara, the most beneficent aspect of the awesome deity Rudra, better known as Shiva. Among mountains, Krishna is Meru, the highest mountain home of Shiva and the other gods, the highest peak and the center of the world. Krishna is consciousness, the symbol Om, and the mantram or holy name. He is the mythic horse and the fabulous elephant that were produced when the cosmic ocean was churned for the elixir of immortality. Krishna is Ananta, the cosmic serpent on which Lord Vishnu sleeps. He is Varuna, Vedic god of the oceans, and Yama, the god of death. Among demons, asuras, he is Prahlada, who, though born in the race of demons, was devoted to God and never swayed in his love, even when his own father tried to kill him. And of course, Krishna is Rama, the great warrior prince, also an incarnation of Vishnu, whose exploits are told in the immortal epic, the Ramayana. Of all fields of knowledge, Krishna says, he is knowledge of the self. The study of Sanskrit and its grammar were important in ancient India, and Krishna doesn't neglect this field. He is A among letters. Among compound words, he is the Dvandva, which joins equals. He is the Gayatri, a particular meter found in the poetry of the Vedas, but generally taken to be a famous prayer from the Rig Veda, chapter 3, part 62, verse 10. Composed in that meter, which has been chanted every morning by countless worshippers for 3,000 years. It is fitting that among seasons, Krishna is the spring, the season of flowers. Less easily understood is his claim to be the gambling of gamblers. Krishna has a sense of play, and as gambling is the obsession of the gambler, it seems natural that Krishna might claim this as a vibhuti. Also, in ancient India, gambling was considered a royal pastime, and no king of repute would refuse a friendly game of dice. In the human realm, Krishna is the son of Vasudeva, a prince of the Vrishni line. In other words, the human form that is Arjuna's friend and charioteer. He is also Arjuna, and he is Vyasa, the composer of the Gita, indeed of the whole Mahabharata. Wherever Arjuna finds strength, beauty, or power, Krishna concludes, he should recognize it as coming from a spark of Krishna's glory. Then, after overwhelming Arjuna with this stupendous list of divine powers and revelations, Krishna asks casually, "But what use is it to know all of these details? The important fact is to know that I am, and that a tiny portion of my being supports all things." Chapter 10. Divine Splendor. Krishna. Listen further, Arjuna, to my supreme teaching, which gives you such joy. Desiring your welfare, O strong-armed warrior, I will tell you more. Neither gods nor sages know my origin, for I am the source from which the gods and sages come. Whoever knows me as the Lord of all creation, without birth or beginning, knows the truth and frees himself from all evil. Discrimination, wisdom, understanding, forgiveness, truth, self-control, and peace of mind. Pleasure and pain, birth and death, fear and courage, honor and dishonor. Non-violence, charity, equanimity, contentment, and perseverance in spiritual disciplines. All the different qualities found in living creatures have their source in me. The seven great sages and the four ancient ancestors were born from my mind and received my power. From them came all the creatures of this world. Whoever understands my power and the mystery of my manifestations comes without doubt to be united with me. I am the source from which all creatures evolve. The wise remember this and worship me with loving devotion. Their thoughts are all absorbed in me, and all their vitality flows to me. Teaching one another, talking about me always, they are happy and fulfilled. To those steadfast in love and devotion, I give spiritual wisdom, so that they may come to me. Out of compassion, I destroy the darkness of their ignorance. From within them, I light the lamp of wisdom and dispel all darkness from their lives. Arjuna, you are Brahman Supreme, the highest abode, the supreme purifier, the self-luminous, eternal spirit, first among the gods, unborn and infinite. The great sages and seers, Narada, Asita, Devala, and Vyasa too, have acclaimed you thus. Now you have declared it to me yourself. Now, O Krishna, I believe that everything you have told me is divine truth. O Lord, neither gods nor demons know your real nature. Indeed, you alone know yourself, O Supreme Spirit. You are the source of being, and the master of every creature, God of gods, the Lord of the universe. Tell me all your divine attributes, leaving nothing unsaid. Tell me of the glories with which you fill the cosmos. Krishna, you are a supreme master of yoga. Tell me how I should meditate to gain constant awareness of you. In what things and in what ways should I meditate on you? O Krishna, you who stir up people's hearts, tell me in detail your attributes and your powers. I can never tire of hearing your immortal words.
Krishna, all right, Arjuna, I will tell you of my divine powers. I will mention only the most glorious, for there is no end to them. I am the true self in the heart of every creature, Arjuna, and the beginning, middle, and end of their existence. Among the shining gods, I am Vishnu. Of luminaries, I am the sun. Among the storm gods, I am Marichi. And in the night sky, I am the moon. Among scriptures, I am the Samaveda. And among the lesser gods, I am Indra. Among the senses, I am the mind. And in living beings, I am consciousness. Among the Rudras, I am Shankara. Among the spirits of the natural world, I am Kubera, god of wealth, and Pavaka, the purifying fire. Among mountains, I am Meru. Among priests, I am Brihaspati. And among military leaders, I am Skanda. Among bodies of water, I am the ocean. Among the great seers, I am Bhrigu. And among words, the syllable Om. I am the repetition of the holy name, and among mountains, I am the Himalayas. Among trees, I am the Ashvata, the sacred fig. Among the Gandhavas, the heavenly musicians, I am Chittaratra. Among divine seers, I am Narada. And among sages, I am Kapila. I was born from the nectar of immortality as the primordial horse and as Indra's noble elephant. Among human beings, I am the king. Among weapons, I am the thunderbolt. I am Kamaduk, the cow that fulfills all desires. I am Kandarpa, the power of sex, and Vasuki, the king of snakes. I am Ananta, the cosmic serpent, and Varuna, the god of water. I am Aryaman among the noble ancestors. Among the forces which restrain, I am Yama, the god of death. Among animals, I am the lion. Among birds, the eagle, Garuda. I am Prahlada, born among the demons. And of all that measures, I am time. Among purifying forces, I am the wind. Among warriors, Rama. Of water creatures, I am the crocodile. And of rivers, I am the Ganges. I am the beginning, middle, and end of creation. Of all the sciences, I am the science of self-knowledge. And I am logic in those who debate. Among letters, I am A. Among grammatical compounds, I am the Dwandva. I am infinite time and the sustainer, whose face is seen everywhere. I am death, which overcomes all, and the source of all beings still to be born. I am the feminine qualities, fame, beauty, perfect speech, memory, intelligence, loyalty, and forgiveness. Among the hymns of the Samaveda, I am the Brihat. Among poetic meters, the Gayatri. Among months, I am Margashirsha, first of the year. Among seasons, I am spring, that brings forth flowers. I am the gambling of the gambler, and the radiance in all that shines. I am effort, I am victory, and I am the goodness of the virtuous. Among the Vrishnis, I am Krishna, and among the Pandavas, I am Arjuna. Among sages, I am Vyasa, and among poets, Ushnas. I am the scepter which metes out punishment, and the art of statesmanship in those who lead. I am the silence of the unknown, and the wisdom of the wise. I am the seed that can be found in every creature, Arjuna, for without me nothing can exist, neither animate nor inanimate. But there is no end to my divine attributes, Arjuna. These I have mentioned are only a few. Wherever you find strength or beauty or spiritual power, you may be sure that these have sprung from a spark of my essence. But of what use is it to you to know all this, Arjuna? Just remember that I am, and that I support the entire cosmos with only a fragment of my being. Chapter 11, The Cosmic Vision. Introduction. This is the most exalted chapter of the entire Gita, for here Arjuna sees the divine vision of Krishna in his full nature, as God himself, Lord of the universe. It is difficult to see at first why the ultimate spiritual vision should be granted to Arjuna at this point. We must remember that Krishna and Arjuna have been companions for many lives. Yet at the opening of the Gita, Arjuna is a warrior, little concerned with mystic visions. Step by step, Krishna has led him to an understanding of the real purpose of his life, to know who he is, and to know also who Krishna is. In the last chapter, Krishna had reached the point where he was willing to reveal to Arjuna the manifestations of divine power. Arjuna had not only asked about these powers, but had even wanted to know in which forms he might meditate on Krishna, the first time Arjuna had spoken of contemplation. Now, in chapter 11, Arjuna asks to see Krishna as he really is. His desire is granted, and in essence, the rest of the chapter describes Arjuna's samadhi. Samadhi is the word used by Patanjali in his classic work, The Yoga Sutras, to describe the final stage in meditation, in which the mind is completely concentrated and a superconscious mode of knowing comes into play. Patanjali speaks of many different kinds of samadhi, but for practical purposes we may speak of two, savikalpa and nirvikalpa. Arjuna's vision begins with savikalpa samadhi, in which he sees God in a personal manifestation. Then, as he passes into nirvikalpa samadhi, Arjuna sees all forms disappearing into God, until only a supernatural fire consuming the entire phenomenal world is left. This supreme vision dazzles Arjuna with the blinding splendor of a thousand suns. Mystics have often described their experiences in terms of light. In an ancient prayer of the Veda, the poet asks for divine wisdom to dawn in his heart, just as the sun rises in the sky. And in the West, we have countless testimonies like that of St. Teresa of Avila. When the soul looks upon this divine sun, the brightness dazzles it, and very often it remains completely blind, absorbed, amazed, and dazzled by all the wonders it sees. As this vision begins to unfold, Arjuna sees the whole world in the body of Krishna, and he begins a hymn of praise. He sees Krishna as Vishnu, with his traditional weapons, the mace and the discus, and wearing a crown. As the vision becomes more intense, Arjuna begins to feel afraid. He sees the light of God become a fire that burns to consume all things as if at the end of time. All the warriors on the battlefield are mortals, and Arjuna sees them slain, burning in the universal fire. All creatures rush to destruction like moths into a flame. God's radiance is both a great light and a burning fire. Terrified, Arjuna wants to know the identity of this awesome God, who bears no resemblance now to the Krishna he has known as his teacher and friend. In answer to the question, "Who are you?" Krishna's reply is the verse, chapter 11, verse 32, that burst into Robert Oppenheimer's mind when he saw the atomic bomb explode over Trinity in the summer of 1945. I am become death, the shatterer of worlds. But the word Kala means not just death, but time, which eventually devours all. Arjuna is brave and worthy of this vision, for he does not lose consciousness or completely break down. He praises Krishna and then asks for forgiveness if during their long friendship he has ever said or done anything to offend the Lord through mistaking him for a mere human being. Finally, the vision is too much for Arjuna. Though he experiences the deep peace and joy of samadhi, he is terrified at the same time. He wishes to see the more human face of God. Krishna grants his desire and returns to his gentle, normal aspect. He tells Arjuna how very difficult it is to see him in his exalted form as the Lord of Yoga, the God of Gods. Only pure devotion attains this vision. This theme dominates the remaining chapters of the Gita. It is devotion that is all important on the spiritual quest. Chapter 11. The Cosmic Vision. Arjuna, out of compassion, you have taught me the supreme mystery of the self. Through your words, my delusion is gone. You have explained the origin and end of every creature, O lotus-eyed one, and told me of your own supreme, limitless existence. Just as you have described your infinite glory, O Lord, now I long to see it. I want to see you as the supreme ruler of creation. O Lord, Master of Yoga, if you think me strong enough to behold it, show me your immortal self. Krishna, behold, Arjuna, a million divine forms with an infinite variety of color and shape. Behold the gods of the natural world and many more wonders never revealed before. Behold the entire cosmos turning within my body and the other things you desire to see. But these things cannot be seen with your physical eyes. Therefore I will give you spiritual vision to perceive my majestic power. Sanjaya, having spoken these words, Krishna, the master of yoga, revealed to Arjuna his most exalted, lordly form. He appeared with an infinite number of faces, ornamented by heavenly jewels, displaying unending miracles and the countless weapons of his power. Clothed in celestial garments and covered with garlands, sweet-smelling with heavenly fragrances, he showed himself as the infinite Lord, the source of all wonders, whose face is everywhere. If 1,000 suns were to rise in the heavens at the same time, the blaze of their light would resemble the splendor of that supreme spirit. There, within the body of the God of Gods, Arjuna saw all the manifold forms of the universe united as one. Filled with amazement, his hair standing on end in ecstasy, he bowed before the Lord with joined palms and spoke these words.
Arjuna, O Lord, I see within your body all the gods and every kind of living creature. I see Brahma, the creator, seated on a lotus. I see the ancient sages and the celestial serpents. I see infinite mouths and arms, stomachs and eyes. And you are embodied in every form. I see you everywhere, without beginning, middle or end. You are the Lord of all creation, and the cosmos is your body. You wear a crown and carry a mace and discus. Your radiance is blinding and immeasurable. I see you, who are so difficult to behold, shining like a fiery sun blazing in every direction. You are the supreme, changeless reality, the one thing to be known.
You are the refuge of all creation, the immortal spirit, the eternal guardian of eternal Dharma. You are without beginning, middle, or end. You touch everything with your infinite power. The sun and moon are your eyes, and your mouth is fire. Your radiance warms the cosmos. O Lord, your presence fills the heavens and the earth and reaches in every direction. I see the three worlds trembling before this vision of your wonderful and terrible form. The gods enter your being, some calling out and greeting you in fear. Great saints sing your glory, praying, "May all be well." The multitudes of gods, demigods, and demons are all overwhelmed by the sight of you. O mighty Lord, at the sight of your myriad eyes and mouths, arms and legs, stomachs and fearful teeth, I and the entire universe shake in terror. O Vishnu, I can see your eyes shining. With open mouth you glitter in an array of colors, and your body touches the sky. I look at you, and my heart trembles. I have lost all courage and all peace of mind. When I see your mouths with their fearful teeth, mouths burning like the fires at the end of time, I forget where I am, and I have no place to go. O Lord, you are the support of the universe. Have mercy on me. I see all the sons of Dhritarashtra. I see Bhishma, Drona, and Karna. I see our warriors and all the kings who are here to fight. All are rushing into your awful jaws. I see some of them crushed by your teeth. As rivers flow into the ocean, all the warriors of this world are passing into your fiery jaws. All creatures rush to their destruction like moths into a flame. You lap the worlds into your burning mouths and swallow them. Filled with your terrible radiance, O Vishnu, the whole of creation bursts into flames. Tell me who you are, O Lord of terrible form. I bow before you. Have mercy. I want to know who you are, you who existed before all creation. Your nature and workings confound me. Krishna, I am time, the destroyer of all. I have come to consume the world. Even without your participation, all the warriors gathered here will die. Therefore arise, Arjuna, conquer your enemies and enjoy the glory of sovereignty. I have already slain all these warriors. You will only be my instrument. Bhishma, Drona, Jayadrata, Karna, and many others are already slain. Kill those whom I have killed. Do not hesitate. Fight in this battle, and you will conquer your enemies.
Sanjaya.
Having heard these words, Arjuna trembled in fear. With joined palms he bowed before Krishna and addressed him, stammering.
Arjuna. O Krishna, it is right that the world delights and rejoices in your praise, that all the saints and sages bow down to you, and all evil flees before you to the far corners of the universe. How could they not worship you, O Lord? You are the eternal spirit who existed before Brahma, the creator, and who will never cease to be. Lord of the gods, you are the abode of the universe. Changeless, you are what is and what is not, and beyond the duality of existence and non-existence.
You are the first among the gods, the timeless spirit, the resting place of all beings. You are the knower and the thing which is known. You are the final home. With your infinite form you pervade the cosmos. You are Vayu, god of wind, Yama, god of death, Agni, god of fire, Varuna, god of water. You are the moon, and the creator Prajapati, and the great-grandfather of all creatures. I bow before you, and salute you again and again. You are behind me and in front of me. I bow to you on every side. Your power is immeasurable. You pervade everything. You are everything. Sometimes, because we were friends, I rashly said, O Krishna, say friend. Casual, careless remarks. Whatever I may have said lightly, whether we were playing or resting, alone or in company, sitting together or eating, if it was disrespectful, forgive me for it, O Krishna. I did not know the greatness of your nature, unchanging and imperishable. You are the father of the universe, of the animate and the inanimate. You are the object of all worship, the greatest guru. There is none to equal you in the three worlds. Who can match your power? O gracious Lord, I prostrate myself before you and ask for your blessing. As a father forgives his son, or a friend, or a lover his beloved, so you should forgive me. I rejoice in seeing you as you have never been seen before. Yet I am filled with fear by this vision of you as the abode of the universe. Please, let me see you again as the shining god of gods. Though you are the embodiment of all creation, let me see you again not with 1,000 arms, but with 4, carrying the mace and discus and wearing a crown. Krishna, Arjuna, through my grace you have been united with me, and receive this vision of my radiant, universal form, without beginning or end, which no one else has ever seen. Not by the knowledge of the Vedas, nor sacrifice, nor charity, nor rituals, nor even by severe asceticism, has any other mortal seen what you have seen, O heroic Arjuna. Do not be troubled. Do not fear my terrible form. Let your heart be satisfied and your fears dispelled in looking at me as I was before. Sanjaya. Having spoken these words, the Lord once again assumed the gentle form of Krishna and consoled his devotee who had been so afraid. Arjuna. O Krishna, now that I have seen your gentle human form, my mind is again composed and returned to normal. Krishna. It is extremely difficult to obtain the vision you have had. Even the gods long always to see me in this aspect. Neither knowledge of the Vedas, nor austerity, nor charity, nor sacrifice can bring the vision you have seen. But through unfailing devotion, Arjuna, you can know me, see me, and attain union with me. Those who make me the supreme goal of all their work and act without selfish attachment, who devote themselves to me completely and are free from ill will for any creature, enter into me. Chapter 12. The Way of Love. Introduction. This short chapter focuses upon the supreme importance of devotion and faith in spiritual development. Here, love, or personal devotion, is the most powerful motivation in spiritual life. The world's great religions agree on this point. All religions allow for a way of devotion, and millions of men and women have found spiritual fulfillment in devotion to Christ, the Buddha, or Muhammad. Hinduism has allowed a place for the path of knowledge as well as the path of devotion. Here, however, the Gita stresses the efficacy of devotion. The Upanishads, the final word on mystical experience uttered by the Vedas, stress the ultimate reality, the eternal truth behind the ephemeral things of this world. The teachers of the Upanishads told their students to seek knowledge of the Atman, their true self. The consummation of this knowledge was to know that the self within was one with Brahman, the ultimate reality pervading all things. This was encapsulated in the statement, Tat Tvam Asi, you are that. That imperishable being, that immortal reality, Brahman, the nameless, formless Godhead, could be known only in the superconscious state. The Gita moves away from such an approach to religion. For as Krishna says, seeking an eternal, indefinable, hidden Godhead is rather a tall order for the average or even above average person. In fact, in this chapter it is said to be beyond the reach of practically all embodied beings. Dehavat, those who have bodies. This path of wisdom may be just too spiritual for Earth's children, because those who identify to a large degree with their physical nature find the way of knowledge too steep a climb. We can turn to one of the Western followers of this path to see why. This is Dionysus the Areopagite, a Christian monk of the 5th century, sounding remarkably like verses 3 and 4 of this very chapter. Then, beyond all distinction between knower and known, the aspirant becomes merged in the nameless, formless reality, wholly absorbed in that which is beyond all things and in nothing else. Having stilled his intellect and mind, he is united by his highest faculty with that which is beyond all knowing. Fortunately, there is the path of love, for when God is loved in personal aspect, the way is vastly easier. According to the Hindu scriptures, God can be loved as a merciful father, a divine mother, a wise friend, a passionate beloved, or even as a mischievous child. We might turn to the Christian mystics for help here, for most of them have walked the way of love. The medieval Christian work called The Cloud of Unknowing states that love is the sure, safe path to God. By love he can be gotten and holden, by thought never. In a well-known passage in the New Testament, St. Paul puts love above knowledge and even above miraculous powers. But I shall give you a more excellent way. Love never faileth. But whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. And St. John of the Cross tells concisely why the vast majority of human beings find it easier to overcome their weaknesses through love than through knowledge. In order to overcome our desires and to renounce all those things, our love and inclination for which are wont to inflame the will that it delights therein, we require a more ardent fire and a nobler love, that of the bridegroom. If our spiritual nature were not on fire with other and nobler passions, we should never cast off the yoke of the senses. But such love is often not forthcoming in the struggling soul, even in one like Arjuna. So Krishna says that if Arjuna is not able to focus his devotion, he should learn to do so through the regular practice of meditation. Even love and devotion can be cultivated through regular practice. They needn't be regarded as mysterious forces, divine gifts of the spirit. If even the attempt at regular practice should fail, Krishna is still not ready to let Arjuna admit defeat. He should, Krishna says, work selflessly without desire for the fruits of his labors. But real peace of mind comes only from renunciation. The word tyaga here seems to mean renunciation or abandonment of self-will more than anything else. Such self-surrender may be a last resort, but if it is genuine, it brings immediate peace. Verses 13 to 20 describe the characteristics of the genuine lover of God. Such a saintly person, Krishna points out, is greatly loved and dear to Krishna himself. Chapter 12. The Way of Love. Arjuna. Of those steadfast devotees who love you, and those who seek you as the eternal, formless reality, who are the more established in yoga? Krishna. Those who set their hearts on me and worship me with unfailing devotion and faith are more established in yoga. As for those who seek the transcendental reality, without name, without form, contemplating the unmanifested, beyond the reach of thought and of feeling, with their senses subdued and mind serene, and striving for the good of all beings, they too will verily come unto me. Yet hazardous and slow is the path to the unrevealed, difficult for physical creatures to tread. But they for whom I am the supreme goal, who do all work renouncing self for me, and meditate on me with single-hearted devotion, these I will swiftly rescue from the fragment cycle of birth and death, for their consciousness has entered into me. Still your mind in me, still your intellect in me, and without doubt you will be united with me forever. If you cannot still your mind in me, learn to do so through the regular practice of meditation. If you lack the will for such self-discipline, engage yourself in my work, for selfless service can lead you at last to complete fulfillment. If you are unable to do even this, surrender yourself to me, disciplining yourself and renouncing the results of all your actions. Better indeed is knowledge than mechanical practice. Better than knowledge is meditation. But better still is surrender of attachment to results, because there follows immediate peace. That one I love, who is incapable of ill will, who is friendly and compassionate, living beyond the reach of I and mine, and of pleasure and pain, patient, contented, self-controlled, firm in faith, with all their heart and all their mind given to me, with such as these I am in love. Not agitating the world or by it agitated, they stand above the sway of elation, competition, and fear. That one is my beloved. They are detached, pure, efficient, impartial, never anxious, selfless in all their undertakings. They are my devotees, very dear to me. That one is dear to me who runs not after the pleasant or away from the painful, grieves not, lusts not, but lets things come and go as they happen. That devotee who looks upon friend and foe with equal regard, who is not buoyed up by praise nor cast down by blame, alike in heat and cold, pleasure and pain, free from selfish attachments, the same in honour and dishonour, quiet, ever full, in harmony everywhere, firm in faith. Such a one is dear to me. Those who meditate upon this immortal Dharma, as I have declared it, full of faith, and seeking me as life's supreme goal, are truly my devotees, and my love for them is very great. Chapter 13. The Field and the Knower. Introduction. This chapter presents us with two sweeping categories, the field and the knower of the field. To simplify, we may think of the field as the body, and the knower of the field as the self that resides in the body. This chapter, then, is about the duality between soul and body. This duality is seen as eternal, a basic division of all things, a fundamental concept elaborated in Sankhya philosophy. We said that the field is the body, but this is not precise enough. The field also includes the mind. In fact, it comprises all the components of prakriti, including ahamkara, the awareness each of us has that we are an individual ego. From aham, I, and kara, maker. Ahamkara is the basic awareness of separateness, that which makes me I, a being separate from the rest of creation. In this wide sense, the field encompasses everything, except for the elusive consciousness that knows the field. The field is the object, the knower is the subject. Krishna is the hidden knower of the field, that is, the self. This term field is a surprisingly modern one, for it describes what today we might call an extension of the continuum of mass, energy, time, and space to include the strata of mind as well. In other words, a field of forces, both physical and mental. Just as physics no longer regards matter and energy as essentially separate, the Gita would not regard matter and mind as separate. They're different aspects of prakriti, the underlying stuff of existence. Another dimension of Krishna's use of the word field is brought out by a traditional Hindu anecdote. A wandering sadhu, or holy man, is asked what his work in life is. He replies, "I am a farmer." When the questioner looks surprised, he adds, "This body of mine is my field. I sow good thoughts and actions, and in my body I reap the results." The Buddha explains, "All that we are is the result of what we have thought. It is founded on our thoughts. It is made of our thoughts. What we think, we become. For as Emerson says, the ancestor of every action is a thought. Thus our thoughts, taken together, bear fruit in the actions, decisions, and desires that shape our lives. In part, the body bears the fruit of what we think, insofar as our way of thinking affects our health and safety. But in a larger sense, the whole field of human activity, indeed the whole of prakriti, is also a field of karma, where, for example, the global environment is shaped by the sum of what its inhabitants do, which in turn is shaped by how they think. This idea will be picked up and elaborated on in detail in the concluding chapters of the Gita. Verses 7 to 11, then, describe the person who understands his or her own true nature. This is an attractive picture of the modest, truly wise person who is in control of his or her own life. One implication of these verses is that it is quite an achievement to understand the difference between the field and the self, the knower. Most people confuse the two, taking the body and mind to be who we are. In the usual course of events, we may be totally unaware that there is a self, a consciousness, beneath the surface awareness of a separate I. Verses 12 to 17 describe the ultimate underlying reality, Brahman, pure, undifferentiated consciousness, the divine ground of existence. Verse 19 returns us to the discussion of the basic duality of mind, matter, and spirit, self. Again, the technical terms prakriti and purusha are used. Purusha is the knower, and prakriti, the field. From the union of these two, all things are born. Both prakriti and purusha are essential to the creation of the world. Nothing could exist without the spiritual basis of purusha, and nothing could develop in a manifest form without the mind and matter of prakriti. With its need to think of abstract principles in human terms, Hinduism embodies these two eternal principles in the figures of Shiva and Shakti, the divine father and mother. The Gita does not mention these two because it comes essentially from the Vishnu tradition, But in the other great stream of the Hindu faith, Shiva is the eternal spirit, the absolute, represented as dwelling aloof on the mountain peak of spiritual peace. Shakti, the divine mother, is his creative partner, and without her, Shiva could never have created the world. Shakti, she has many names in her various manifestations, rules in the realm of birth and death. Shiva, Purusha, lives in the realm of the immortal. Together, the two represent Brahman, the attributeless Godhead and the creative power of the Godhead called Maya. Thus, it is in the union of Shiva and Shakti that all things are born. This chapter emphasizes that the self, the real knower, is ever uninvolved in the shifting forces that play over the field. There is no possibility of any soul being eternally lost, for all beings partake of the immortal, pure nature of Purusha. We may endure countless eons of birth and death, but we must finally find our rest in the eternal spirit. By definition, nothing taking place in the realm of Prakriti can affect Purusha. But the exact nature of the interaction of these two is a profound mystery. Verse 32 explains this mystery by drawing a comparison with Akasha, the subtlest element recognized by the ancient philosophers. Akasha is space itself. Just as space pervades the cosmos, yet remains pure, even in the midst of impure things, so the self remains completely pure, even though it dwells in all things. Though it seems to live in the land of mortals and to undergo change and death, the real knower in every creature is deathless, hidden in the heart. Chapter 13. The Field and the Knower. Krishna. The body is called a field, Arjuna. The one who knows it is called the knower of the field. This is the knowledge of those who know. I am the knower of the field in everyone, Arjuna. Knowledge of the field and its knower is true knowledge. Listen, and I will explain the nature of the field and how change takes place within it. I will also describe the knower of the field and his power. These truths have been sung by great sages in a variety of ways and expounded in precise arguments concerning Brahman. The field, Arjuna, is made up of the following: the five areas of sense perception, the five elements, the five sense organs, and the five organs of action, the three components of the mind, manas, buddhi, and ahamkara, and the undifferentiated energy from which all these evolved. In this field arise desire and aversion, pleasure and pain, the body, intelligence, and will. Those who know truly are free from pride and deceit. They are gentle, forgiving, upright, and pure, devoted to their spiritual teacher, filled with inner strength, and self-controlled. Detached from sense objects and self-will, they have learned the painful lesson of separate birth and suffering, old age, disease, and death. Free from selfish attachment, they do not get compulsively entangled, even in home and family. They are even-minded through good fortune and bad. Their devotion to me is undivided. Enjoying solitude and not following the crowd, they seek only me. This is true knowledge, to seek the self as the true end of wisdom always. To seek anything else is ignorance. I will tell you of the wisdom that leads to immortality, the beginningless Brahman, which can be called neither being
nor non-being.
It dwells in all, in every hand and foot and head, in every mouth and eye and ear in the universe. Without senses itself, it shines through the functioning of the senses. Completely independent, it supports all things. Beyond the gunas, it enjoys their play. It is both near and far, both within and without every creature. It moves and is unmoving. In its subtlety, it is beyond comprehension. It is indivisible, yet appears divided in separate creatures. Know it to be the creator, the preserver, and the destroyer. Dwelling in every heart, it is beyond darkness. It is called the light of light, the object and goal of knowledge, and knowledge itself. I have revealed to you the nature of the field, and the meaning and object of true knowledge. Those who are devoted to me, knowing these things, are united with me. Know that Prakriti and Purusha are both without beginning, and that from Prakriti come the gunas and all that changes. Prakriti is the agent, cause and effect of every action, but it is Purusha that seems to experience pleasure and pain. Purusha, resting in Prakriti, witnesses the play of the gunas born of Prakriti, but attachment to the gunas leads a person to be born for good or evil. Within the body, the Supreme Purusha is called the witness, approver, supporter, enjoyer, the Supreme Lord, the highest self. Whoever realizes the true nature of Purusha, Prakriti, and the gunas, whatever path he or she may follow, is not born separate again. Some realize the self within them through the practice of meditation, some by the path of wisdom, and others by selfless service. Others may not know these paths, but hearing and following the instructions of an illumined teacher, they too go beyond death. Whatever exists, Arjuna, animate or inanimate, is born through the union of the field and its knower. They alone see truly, who see the Lord the same in every creature, who see the deathless in the hearts of all that die. Seeing the same Lord everywhere, they do not harm themselves or others. Thus they attain the supreme goal. They alone see truly who see that all actions are performed by Prakriti, while the self remains unmoved. When they see the variety of creation rooted in that unity and growing out of it, they attain fulfillment in Brahman. This supreme self is without a beginning, undifferentiated, deathless. Though it dwells in the body, Arjuna, it neither acts nor is touched by action. As Akasha pervades the cosmos but remains unstained, the self can never be tainted, though it dwells in every creature. As the sun lights up the world, the self dwelling in the field is the source of all light in the field. Those who, with the eye of wisdom, distinguish the field from its knower, and the way to freedom from the bondage of Prakriti, attain the supreme goal. Chapter 14. The Forces of Evolution. Introduction. The last chapter gave us the distinction between Purusha and Prakriti. This chapter will tell us in more detail about the nature of Prakriti, the basis of the world of mind and matter. Here the Gita explains human experience in terms of the three qualities of Prakriti, known as the gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. When the soul attains illumination, it goes beyond the confines of Prakriti into the spiritual realm of Purusha. But until then, the soul must learn to deal with these three all-powerful forces. No single English word can be given to translate the words sattva, rajas, and tamas. The quality of sattva combines goodness, purity, light, harmony, balance. In terms of evolution, sattva is on the highest level. Rajas is energy, or on the human level, passion, which can be both good and bad. In personality, rajas may express itself in anger, hatred, or greed. But it also provides motivation, the will to act. Rajas is ambitious, which is not altogether a bad thing for the evolution of the soul. It is definitely superior to the third guna, tamas, which combines inertia, sloth, darkness, ignorance, insensitivity. This is the lowest state in terms of evolution, for tamas means a dead stability, where nothing much happens for good or ill. Worse, tamas can mean not just stability, but a sliding backwards in the struggle of evolution, where to stand still may mean to be left behind. Chapter 14, verse 18. In any given personality or phenomenon, all the three gunas are likely to be present. It is the mix of the three that colours our experience. Sattva may be dominant, with an admixture of rajas or tamas, or perhaps rajas dominates with a little sattva and a good measure of tamas. Finally, the personality may be basically tamasic, with a few rays of the light of sattva and a little of the heat of rajas. In any case, no mix of the three gunas is stable, for it is the very nature of prakriti to be in constant flux. The gunas are constantly shifting, always changing in intensity. It is essential that the gunas, even the purity and goodness of sattva, be transcended if the soul is to attain its final release. For the three gunas are forces that operate within the world of prakriti. In fact, their three strands make up the whole fabric of the phenomenal world. Liberation lies beyond the conditioning of prakriti in the realm of Purusha. When Arjuna asks Krishna to describe the person who has gone beyond Prakriti's net, Krishna replies that such a person is detached from the constant shifting and interaction of the gunas. Identified with the self, he or she realizes that the gunas and their play are external. Even the emotions and thoughts that seem so personal, so interior, are really only the play of Prakriti. Thoughts and emotions and ahamkara itself stop at the gate of the inner self. The self abides in the inner chamber of the heart, always at peace, whatever forces of prakriti may storm outside. The illumined man or woman maintains a joyful evenness of mind in happiness and sorrow. At the end of the chapter, again reminding him of the power of devotion, bhakti, Krishna says that Arjuna can transcend the gunas through steadfast love. If he has devotion and has gone beyond the three gunas, then he will be fit to know Brahman. Chapter 14. The Forces of Evolution. Krishna. Let me tell you more about the wisdom that transcends all knowledge, through which the saints and sages attained perfection. Those who rely on this wisdom will be united with me. For them there is neither rebirth nor fear of death. My womb is Prakriti. In that I place the seed. Thus all created things are born. Everything born, Arjuna, comes from the womb of Prakriti, and I am the seed-giving father. It is the three gunas born of Prakriti, sattva, rajas, and tamas, that bind the immortal self to the body. Sattva, pure, luminous, and free from sorrow, binds us with attachment to happiness and wisdom. Rajas is passion arising from selfish desire and attachment. These bind the self with compulsive action. Tamas, born of ignorance, deludes all creatures through heedlessness, indolence, and sleep. Sattva binds us to happiness. Rajas binds us to action. Tamas, distorting our understanding, binds us to delusion. Sattva predominates when rajas and tamas are transformed. Rajas prevails when sattva is weak and tamas overcome. Tamas prevails when rajas and sattva are dormant. When sattva predominates, the light of wisdom shines through every gate of the body. When rajas predominates, a person runs about, pursuing selfish and greedy ends, driven by restlessness and desire. When tamas is dominant, a person lives in darkness, slothful, confused, and easily infatuated. Those dying in the state of sattva attain the pure worlds of the wise. Those dying in rajas are reborn among people driven by work. But those who die in tamas are conceived in the wombs of the ignorant. The fruit of good deeds is pure and sattvic. The fruit of rajas is suffering. The fruit of tamas is ignorance and insensitivity. From sattva comes understanding. From rajas, greed. But the outcome of tamas is confusion, infatuation, and ignorance. Those who live in sattva go upwards. Those in rajas remain where they are, but those immersed in tamas sink downwards. The wise see clearly that all action is the work of the gunas. Knowing that which is above the gunas, they enter into union with me. Going beyond the three gunas, which form the body, they leave behind the cycle of birth and death, decrepitude and sorrow, and attain to immortality. Arjuna, what are the characteristics of those who have gone beyond the gunas, O Lord? How do they act? How have they passed beyond the gunas' hold? Krishna, they are unmoved by the harmony of sattva, the activity of rajas, or the delusion of tamas. They feel no aversion when these forces are active, nor do they crave for them when these forces subside. They remain impartial, undisturbed by the actions of the gunas. Knowing that it is the gunas which act, they abide within themselves and do not vacillate. Established within themselves, they are equal in pleasure and pain, praise and blame, kindness and unkindness. Clay, a rock, and gold are the same to them, alike in honor and dishonor, alike to friend and foe. They have given up every selfish pursuit. Such are those who have gone beyond the gunas. By serving me with steadfast love, a man or woman goes beyond the gunas. Such a one is fit for union with Brahman. For I am the support of Brahman, the eternal, the unchanging, the deathless, the everlasting Dharma, the source of all joy. Chapter 15. The Supreme Self. Introduction. This is a difficult chapter, for it deals essentially with questions of theology, an ultimate mystical experience. Krishna reveals that he transcends not only the world of matter, but also the immortal Atman that dwells as the conscious knower within all beings. Krishna has said that he is the Atman, but the paradox is that he also transcends the Atman. In this highest aspect, Krishna is Ishvara, the cosmic Lord, who abides in his own mystery. The liberated self enjoys union with Krishna and lives in Krishna's highest home, but the self does not become Krishna. The immortal soul, even when liberated from its mortal journeying, does not become God. The chapter opens with the image of an upside-down tree, a world tree, rooted in Brahman, which branches out into a manifold creation in this realm below. This is said to be an ashvata, or pipal tree, a kind of fig. Like the banyan, it sends out roots into the air, spreading above and below. In this chapter about Krishna's most exalted nature, it is appropriate that his home, the highest goal of all, is described. It is an abode of light, an eternal life. By its very nature, it is beyond the description of human language. Verse 4 uses an elemental and ancient word for the ultimate reality that defies all description, all human thought. Tat, which means simply that, or it. Here, the Gita personalizes Tat to the extent of giving it a home. Avyayam Padam, the immortal home, the eternal goal. Pada also means foot or step, and it is of interest here to recall a myth from the Vedas. At the beginning of time, Vishnu took three steps that measured out the entire cosmos. In the Rig Veda, Part 1, Chapter 154, Verse 5, the poet longs to find himself in this home of the God. May I go to his blessed world, where those who love the gods rejoice, for there truly is the company of the far-stepping God, a fountain of honey in the highest step of Vishnu. The Gita describes Krishna's home as a realm of light, beyond the light of the sun, chapter 15, verse 6. Here we might compare the Gita with the Katha Upanishad, chapter 5, verse 15. There shines not the sun, neither moon, nor star, nor flash of lightning, nor fire lit on earth. The Self is the light reflected by all. He shining, everything shines after him. Even here, though, we are reminded that Krishna lives not just in the highest realm, but also in the world below, where both darkness and light coexist. In his divine mystery, he sends fragments of himself to become the inner self in each creature. In this sense, the self enters the body at conception, dwells in the body, and then departs at death. Krishna is the prana, the breath or vitality of the body. The Upanishads speak of five pranas. Here the Gita mentions the two most prominent, the prana by which we breathe and the prana that digests food. Chapter 15, The Supreme Self. Krishna. Sages speak of the immutable Ashvatthara tree, with its taproot above and its branches below. On this tree grow the scriptures. Seeing their source, one knows their essence. Nourished by the gunas, the limbs of this tree spread above and below. Sense objects grow on the limbs as buds. The roots hanging down bind us to action in this world. The true form of this tree, its essence, beginning and end, is not perceived on this earth. Cut down this strong-rooted tree with the sharp axe of detachment. Then find the path which does not come back again. Seek that, the first cause, from which the universe came long ago. Not deluded by pride, free from selfish attachment and selfish desire, beyond the duality of pleasure and pain, ever aware of the self, the wise go forward to that eternal goal. Neither the sun, nor the moon, nor fire can add to that light. This is my supreme abode, and those who enter there do not return to separate existence. An eternal part of me enters into the world, assuming the powers of action and perception and a mind made of prakriti. When the divine self enters and leaves a body, it takes these along, as the wind carries a scent from place to place. Using the mind, ears, eyes, nose, and the senses of taste and touch, the self enjoys sense objects. The deluded do not see the self when it leaves the body, or when it dwells within it. They do not see the self enjoying sense objects or acting through the gunas. But they who have the eye of wisdom see. Those who strive resolutely on the path of yoga see the self within. The thoughtless who strive imperfectly do not. The brightness of the sun, which lights up the world, the brightness of the moon and of fire, these are my glory. With a drop of my energy, I enter the earth and support all creatures. Through the moon, the vessel of life-giving fluid, I nourish all plants. I enter breathing creatures and dwell within as the life-giving breath. I am the fire in the stomach, which digests all food. Entering into every heart, I give the power to remember and understand. It is I again who take that power away. All the scriptures lead to me. I am their author and their wisdom. In this world, there are two orders of being: the perishable, separate creature, and the changeless spirit. But beyond these, there is another, the Supreme Self, the Eternal Lord, who enters into the entire cosmos and supports it from within. I am that Supreme Self, praised by the scriptures as beyond the changing and the changeless. Those who see in me that Supreme Self see truly. They have found the source of all wisdom, Arjuna, and they worship me with all their heart. I have shared this profound truth with you, Arjuna. Those who understand it will attain wisdom. They will have done that which has to be done.